Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The topic is Nazariyatul Ma'rifah, theory of knowledge. Theory of knowledge. If I want to explain to you what it is about, and start like this, you know. And this you can also, someone asks you, what are you studying? You can say, you know, people believe in things, and what they believe in, they have to have a reason why they believe in it. People have beliefs. You have belief in, for example, that you were created. Or you have belief that, you know, there is a God. You believe in a life after death. You believe in, for example, that there were prophets. Or there is a need for prophets. These are beliefs that we all have. As Muslims, Christians have beliefs. Can I ask you what they believe in? Christians believe in, give me those two, three major things they believe in.
They believe in Jesus.
Jesus as the
Son of God.
Now what else do they believe in?
Holy Ghost. Yeah, Trinity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Buddhists believe in stuff, you know, and other religions. Those who are not religious, religion means basically something that's divine, that's revealed. But there are other systems who are that are not religions, but there are ways people live their lives, you know. But each belief system has a reason. If you say, for example, I believe in this, I believe in God, and I ask you, why do you believe in God? Well, would it be okay to say, for you to say, for example, I believe in God because I feel like it? No, this is not a reason, right? Well, I have to choose something, so I chose this one, for example. Right? You have to, or you cannot say, for example, something that's meaningless. I mean, you can think about other meaningless things that sometimes, you know, that are not really reasons. So you have to have a reason why. Now, this is point number one. For every belief, there has to be a reason. Second thing is, the reason that you give for a certain belief, the reason has to be authentic, acceptable. You, for example, if you give a reason that's not authentic, like the one I give, you know, I feel like doing it, you know. Or even, for example, as the email that went out, you know, why do you believe in God, said what? Did you read the email?
I'm a Muslim or something.
Yeah, I believe in God because I'm a Muslim. Now, a Muslim means a person who believes in God. So, I'm a Muslim, I believe in God. It's like going in a circle, you know. Okay, and why do you believe in God? Because you're a Muslim. What is a Muslim? A Muslim is a person who believes in God. So, it's really a perfect circle. It's not explaining it. The person says, but I want to know both things. Why are you Muslim? Why are you believing in God? So if you don't give a reason that you know is acceptable, that is, you know, authentic, mu'tabar is in Arabic, they say Urdu also mu'tabar, you know, something authentic, something that's reliable, it's as good as not giving a reason. Something like the example, like Brother Yusuf says, you know, I don't have any money in my pocket. And I say, I do have $100. And these $100 I just printed on my home printer, you know. I just like took $100, I copied it, print, color copied. And I said, this is a $100 bill. And he says, I don't have any money. Am I any better than him? Do I have $100? No, I don't. Because this $100 is not authentic, right? The reason, in the same way, when you give a reason for something, the logic for something, the logic has to be mu'tabar, authentic. How do we know what logic, what proof, what reason is authentic and what is not? Everyone in this world has a different belief system and is giving reasons for it. And that's what we are encountering all the time. People giving reasons for different kinds of things they believe in. And there should be a science where these reasons, these dalail, these arguments are collected, right? Classified, right, and understood do they actually prove what they are claiming to prove? So there has to be a science where these different arguments people give, reasons people present, right? You collect them in one place and discuss their validity. Hujjiyat, they call in Arabic. That means, do they actually prove something? Do they prove what they are supposed to prove? To say, for example, that, well, I believe in God because my parents told me to believe in God. Well, it's a reason. It sounds like a reason, but is it mu'tabar? Is it authentic? Or this reason is not authentic, right? Am I using the right word? Correct me. Give me a better word if you see that this is probably I'm not using the best word. So, somewhere, some science, some field of knowledge should be actually just talking about the reasons themselves. Science doesn't. Even religion, for example, every religion presents its own reasons. Islam presents its arguments. Buddhism presents its logic. Communism presents its logic, right? Materialism, other fields. Everyone is giving his reasons. But there's no one to say, for example, okay, you know, this is where you all come and bring all these arguments together and talk about whether they are valid or not. And to what extent are they valid? So you have to have a place where you collect these arguments, you talk about their authenticity, whether they're proving something or not, and third, what are the limits of their hujjiyat, their validity, what their authenticity, you know? Again, example of a dollar. For example, dollar is a currency in the United States. If I take this currency in some parts of the world where people do not, for example, buy and sell in dollars, or other currencies may be better examples of that, you know? Tuman, for example, you pick up tumans from Iran, you go to Middle East, you can't spend them. They don't exchange the tumans on the airports or any other place. So currency is valid within a country's limits. Similarly, arguments are valid within a certain domain. Not every argument can prove everything. So you have to know to what extent can you prove something with this argument, this level, this kind of argument. So arguments have to be collected, dalail, you know, these proofs, these reasons have to be collected in one place, classified into kinds and branches and, you know, categories, and then talk about whether what they prove and the limits of how much they prove. So it's not like trespassing. You're using wrong argument for wrong kind of thing. Some arguments apply to one kind of thing, other arguments apply to another kind of thing, right? This is just very, very basic information. Tell me if it's not clear, or if any questions or something. Is it clear? For example, sensory argument. I saw something, I didn't see something, I touched something, I felt something. These are good to prove what kind of things? Something tangible, physical, material, right? But something that's not material, thoughts, for example, feelings, for example, right? Hunger, sadness, happiness. Are you happy? Are you sad? You know? Are you smart? Are you not? Right? These things, you cannot... Is there any way to prove it by touching it? By feeling it? Looking at it? Smelling it? Five senses that we have. So to ask someone to prove that you are happy by your senses, you prove that you are sad by your senses, for example. Tell me that you are sad by using your five senses. What would you do, for example? You say, you know, yes?
Your eyes.
Your eyes, well, you say, you know, he looks sad. But what if the person says, smile, you know? It's the way to tell.
What if they're crying?
What if they're crying? Tearfulness? Tearfulness is an expression, right? Is an emotion, as they say, or affect. I think that's what the word they use. But the emotion or the feeling is deeper than anywhere. Does it make sense? You have a question? So, as you know, you come across people who are deep inside very sad, but they wear a mask of happiness all the time, you know. How are you doing? Doing good? Happy? But they're actually very sad. Or people sometimes who are sad, but, you know, they're happy, but vice versa. Anyway, they were just examples, so don't get confused with examples. I would just give examples to illustrate the point, okay? So you need a field of knowledge. This theory of knowledge is the field, is the discipline where you actually do this. You collect all these arguments, classify them, talk about whether they're authentic or not, you know, and how much do they work, to what extent do they work. And now we are talking about importance of studying this topic, this subject. The importance, two reasons why this is important for us to learn. Well, first reason is that we want to have a worldview, a belief system, right? A worldview that is true. A worldview that is true. Whether there is a God or there isn't a God, we want to figure out what is really the fact. If there is a God, have a worldview about creation. God created things, this is how God is, this is how He created, this is what He expects, the purpose for this creation. And this is a worldview, right? This is what the purpose is for. Is He creating all this for Himself? Is He creating it for others, for us? What do we want to achieve? What is our final goal? All of those things will form a worldview. Well, any human being would just, you know, look at this world and say, well, let me make sense of where I am, right? And by doing it, he's actually, in a way, philosophizing, thinking in broad terms to see, okay, where this whole thing comes from, where is it going? How am I related to this environment? What am I supposed to do? Right? A very simple example would not be a perfect example. Like, you are in a workplace, you don't know what are you expected to do. They ask you to report at 8 o'clock. And you are there and you don't know what to do. You have to find out somebody. Tell me why you asked me to come. You employed me for what? What am I supposed to do? Walk around the corridors, say hi to everybody or what? So you have to kind of learn to figure out what your responsibility is, where this company is heading, what is the goal, right? This is an example. So you want to have a worldview. Now, while you have a worldview, you want to have a vocabulary by which people with different worldviews can communicate with each other, right? This is point number two. A common language by which people can communicate with each other. If you do not have a common language to communicate with a person of another belief, right, it's like everyone is wearing colored glasses, different colors. One is wearing a red colored glass, another is wearing a blue colored glass, another a green colored glass. And they don't really see the things as they are. Everyone is looking at a different thing. So they cannot. You know? So you need a scale of measurement that applies to all. Like, kilogram is kilogram for everyone, right? Again, example. Yes?
Milana, could you give the example of when you were on the airplane and talking about the, you know, Bible and Quran?
Yes. I was giving the example earlier. For example, when I was on a plane, this girl next to me, high school student, I think, she had collected some $5,000-$6,000, and she wanted to go to India to do some kind of missionary work or humanitarian work. So she was very passionate about Bible and Christianity and all of that stuff, so we got into a little bit of conversation, so we started bringing stuff from Bible. The moment she started, and then she said, you know, what do you say about this, about your faith, you know, like very pretty direct, you know. You're like a very polite girl, but that kind of trying to engage. So I said, well, before I give you an answer, let's just make something clear, you know. Do you believe in my book? So she said no. I said, well, same here. I don't believe in your book. Right? So Menaka, is that clear? Is that straight? She says, yes. We don't believe in each other's book. I said, so what's the point in me telling you what my book tells about, says, or for me, you to tell me what your Bible, your book tells me, teaches about this subject, right? So there's no common ground. There's no common ground. There are contradictions between what Bible says and what Quran says. So there is no common ground to have a theological discussion between two people when they believe in different theologies. This kind of dialogue is it's not a useful dialogue. It does not bring people together to talk on the same level, you know. It's like talking about two different things. Is it making sense?
Even in the same belief, people are just like shallow. We heard that we don't go follow the detail and...
Exactly. For example, if the language, if a common language between two Shia people is not there, they haven't learned logic. They haven't learned to, you know, talk in logical terms. They are talking, one is talking about some tradition, a ritual or something, another is quoting from Quran, the third person is saying, you know, experiments prove this. Then another person says, you know, my grandfather was a mystic, he saw in a vision Imam Hussain telling him this. Now each is following a different, each is coming from a different, totally different standpoint, approaching the subject from a different, you know, dimension, right? And there's no way to bring these people together. So as long as they stick to their approach, each person sticks to his own approach or her own approach, and they are trying to talk to each other. Actually, what they are doing is each one giving his speech. Let me best explain how I approach this subject. The other person says, let me best explain how good my grandfather was. The third person says, let me explain to you the best way, for example, the hadith I learned it can be translated. The third
That's
person,
how we grow up. When Amar's age, I didn't know what Amar knows. Because it was all traditional things.
All of us? Yep. People, since they have different approaches, arguments can be classified in different categories. The approaches are in each category is different from the other. Even talking about the same subject, people do not come close. People do not have a common ground. And that's why, unfortunately, the interfaith dialogue usually fails. Because it's a theological dialogue. For example, you have an interfaith program of Christians, Jews and Muslims. They all come together, right? It's not a dialogue. Each is giving a speech to the crowd. And I've been to many. Like I, as a Muslim priest, I speak, you know, Quran says this, and the Christian says, Bible says this. The Jewish saying, In fact, from the Jews and from, I think, almost every denomination, you'll find some secular people. A secular Christian, a secular Jewish, a secular Muslim in every crowd. And they'll say, you know, none of that makes any sense. You have to be good, a good person. Yeah, he has his own approach, you know. Each is giving his speech. Just addressing the topic from his approach, there is really no dialogue. Because when I tried to engage on the stage I was sitting, all these people, members of different faith groups were sitting over there, I tried to, instead of talking to the crowd, I was saying, all of these people are talking to the crowd for the last hour and a half. So I turned to them and said, what do you say about this subject, by the way? And I could see that there was no common ground. Because they're talking about Trinity, and I'm engaging them to accept Tawheed. I said, well, three gods or one, at least one we all accept, right? Even a child accepts there's one God. They didn't accept what I was saying. I thought it was making sense. Because for even a child to understand this, well, again, it's my perspective, right? So they were not getting it. And they did not respond the way I would have thought that, you know, it's a nice proposal to accept, for example, the very, very simple, clear thing that there's one God. Well, why don't we accept it? But he didn't take it that way. It wasn't that simple. So it was a failed attempt. Interfaith dialogues, when each is presenting his arguments from his or her particular viewpoint, approach that he's using, right? This kind of theological discussion fails. If I ask you, conferences on physics, chemistry, astronomy, neuroscience, I don't know, biology, other places, conferences on other subjects, do they fail like this? You have a conference on, for example, counseling, psychology, new advances in psychology to treat, for example, some post-traumatic stress disorder. New approaches, right? Now, people, scholars from around the world have come together presenting their papers, talking about their approaches, their research, right? Surveys, I don't know, the scientific methods they're using. They talk about it. Now, sometimes you see there's a disagreement also. One says this approach works better, the other says that one. One theorizes, you know, develops a framework in one way, the others present a different framework to understand that topic, right? They are disagreeing. But they all know that they agree on the method. The application is different, right? A slight variation. Or they're saying that, okay, so you, this is your approach, this is my approach. And they all, in spite of their disagreements, they all come together in the end. They say, okay, we appreciate the fact that we have presented these different researches, and each from a different approach, and we will take it from there next time. Alaykum As-salam. So there is really no dispute when there is a conference on physics. How are you? Please. No problem, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, when there is a conference on a scientific subject, right, people come and present their research. Sometimes there is disagreement between one professor and another, one research scholar and another, right? But this disagreement does not cause a conflict. They don't start, for example, fighting or cursing each other. They don't. They disagree, you know, you are using a different approach and my approach tells me this works better. Fine. They both appreciate, okay, this is how, you know, the approach used by this scholar is this, the other one used that approach. So each makes sense. But maybe the surveys are not complete. Maybe there should be more experiments done on something. So that both appreciate this part and they say, okay, let's concentrate more on more research on, for example, collecting more surveys, more samples. Or let's do some more research on, for example, you know, observing more, you know, with physical changes, whatever it is, you know. They say, let's go on and do some more of that. And they conclude their conference and peacefully go home. But imagine a discussion on religious subject between Shia and Sunni. And each is presenting his theological, historical perspective, hadith, right? They are presenting their viewpoint, now we are presenting our viewpoint, right? Now they are saying, my book says this, this, this. He says, my book says this. Or even more clear example would be between Muslims and Christians. They say, well, Bible says, for example, Father and Son and whatever, Holy Ghost. Let's assume. Now, Muslim says, you know, there's one God, and they're all prophets of God. And they say, there's a Son of God. The Muslim says, no, God doesn't have a son. Qulhu Allahu Ahad, stuff like that. But both are presenting their viewpoints. It's a theological debate. Do you get a result from this kind of debate? You generally don't, right? Either you assimilate, you say, oh, you know what, everybody is right. Everybody is right. There's no right and wrong, actually. Either you say there's no right or wrong, or you say, you know what, everybody is right. Because, you know, each is trying to find a way to the truth. Now, we don't know what is the right way, so everyone can follow his way, and it's okay, and that's fine. You kind of brush it under the carpet and leave it at that. Don't want to really, you know, directly approach this subject, open it up, discuss it. You don't want to avoid confrontation. Because if you really openly debate this issue, it becomes an argument, and a discussion and theological argument is often, you know, has no result. Ask me a question if you think it's not clear or something. So we want, the first point was that we want to, you know, develop a worldview. That's why we are studying this topic, theory of knowledge. to understand the world around us, where it came from, where it's going. This is the worldview. The second importance of why we are studying this subject is so that we have a common language by which we can speak to other people, right? And we can have religious conferences, dialogues, just as peacefully and productively as a conference on physics, chemistry, or biology, right? So, conference, a dialogue on beliefs, for example, should be done just as a conference on sociology. And how can we do that? If I ask you, and I want you all to think about this a little bit, how can we do that? This discourse is basically meant to help you find and discover and understand that way, that approach, rational, logical approach, by which any two people or group of people from different faith backgrounds, religious traditions or non-religious traditions, can speak on a subject, right, and have a framework that they both accept, right, and see. Perhaps one has beliefs in one way, the other believes in another way, but they will be able to appreciate where the other person is coming from, right? And, well, if we want to understand there's a truth and we want to figure out what that truth is, then one way is to put all these different belief systems in front of us, collect all the books about Christianity, Buddhism, all kinds of belief systems in this world, and study all of them. Have a comparative study of 500 religious traditions, for example, right? And then and compare them and figure out which one is right, which one is wrong. That's one way to do it. Sounds like a lot of work, right? But the other way to do it is we approach the subject, we present what is the right method, correct? Based on rational reasoning, logic. And then when the truth becomes clear, you can compare all the falsehood that's out there. In our history of Islam, Shia Islam, it goes beyond, before the Holy Prophet. The work and philosophy started 5-6 millenniums ago. You know, before the Greeks, the work in philosophy was done in Iran, Persia of those times. Fahlaviyin, they used to call them. They did work. Because they were prophets in all areas, again, from our viewpoint. But philosophy as a general subject has grown over 5 millenniums at least. Greeks have done work, Aristotle and a lot of philosophers in Greece. And before them were Persian philosophers. And after the Greeks, well, philosophy was translated into Arabic. And then philosophy, the work in philosophy continued in Iran and Iraq and among Arabs and Persians. So it has been continuing. So that approach is what we want to summarize here. Just a very brief overview of philosophy as it relates to our subject. Approaches to discovering the reality. That's what our topic is. You want to add something, Brother Yusuf?
I think if we, take a look at,
talk
about maybe look at the story, the illustration of the,
yes,
like the carpenter and the auto mechanic.
Yes, explain it. You go ahead.
Okay. From the first session that we had of this course with Maulana, and he gave an example of, basically the central issue in this course is this idea of using the wrong approach to knowledge to justify a belief. And this is a mistake that, we make all the time, and especially like Maulana was saying, in religious debates and everything, mm-hmm. to try to justify belief to someone, but using the wrong approach, the wrong type of knowledge. And so theory of knowledge is to basically classify these different approaches to knowledge and understand, like, for each one, and there are four that we're going to talk about, for each one, what the limits of it are and where it can be applied. So for instance, just because one approach to knowledge can't be applied to a certain area, doesn't mean, like for instance, Maulana was talking about the debates between Christians and Muslims. So just because, of course, quoting Quran to a Christian might not have effectiveness, it might be limited in that way, of course doesn't undermine any value of, you know, of the knowledge that you've gained from the Quran. So one of these ideas is that to say that knowledge can't, or an approach to knowledge can't be applied to a certain area, doesn't mean it's not valuable, it just means you're trying to use it in the wrong place. And so it doesn't work, you know, when you're trying to use it there. So we put together this story, The Carpenter and the Flat Tire. If you look in the introduction, it's after the preface, and then the introduction, the first page, it starts there. So, you know, take a look at the story, you know, later on if you get a chance, but I'll talk about it. So basically the idea is, you know, it's not a true story. It's meant to illustrate, you know, the use of knowledge, you know, to do something. So the idea is there's this master carpenter, okay, so he's been working on furniture and houses using, you know, he has a workshop, and he's very skilled at using tools like a hammer and saws and things like this to repair furniture, to build furniture, and to work on houses. So one day he gets up in the morning, he goes out to his driveway, and he sees that his car has a flat tire. And he thinks to himself, well, you know, fortunately, you know, I'm this skilled, you know, worker, and I have this workshop full of tools. So he decides he's going to go into his workshop full of woodworking tools and find the things that he needs to fix his flat. So he thinks, okay, I need to take the tire off, I need to be able to patch the tire and then put the tire back on the car. So he gets his saw, because he figures, you know, this is what I can use to take the tire off of the car. And then he gets, you know, some scrap pieces of wood, because he thinks, okay, I can put this over the hole, you know, and hammer it on, you know, and cover the hole in the tire. And he gets some nails and his hammer so that he can, you know, put the tire back on the car. Then these are all valuable tools to him, of course, in his trade. So he brings these tools out and he works on the tire. He spends the whole day, works really hard, but by the end, you know, he realizes that he's, you know, the car is more ruined than it was before, because he's ruined the tire, it's all torn up, and then in trying to hammer the wheel back on, he's, you know, bent everything up and warped it. And so he's really frustrated. He lays down on the driveway, you know, in despair, and, you know, he basically feels like, you know, he's worthless, right? And all these tools that he's been using all these years, everything, you know, and all his skills and knowledge, that it's of no use, right? Because obviously he's failed. But then he has this friend who's an auto mechanic who comes by, and the auto mechanic sees him, you know, and sees the car, and he says, what's wrong? You know, and the carpenter says, well, you know, I don't know what happened, but all this time, you know, I thought these tools were really good, and I thought I knew what I was doing, but when it comes to a simple flat tire, I can't even fix this. And then the auto mechanic points out to him, you know, it's not that your tools aren't worthless and you're a good carpenter and all that thing, but you're using the wrong tools to try to fix this flat tire. So he brings some of his tools over and he says, look, these are the tools that work on this, and if you use these tools, then, you know, you can fix it. And he says, but I know how you feel, because the auto mechanic, he says, when I had to repair my roof and I tried to use, you know, a wrench and a screwdriver, you know, and bolts, you know, and all these things, and it was a disaster. So the auto mechanics, or the carpenter says, you know, well, this is amazing, this is great. You know, I never knew that different tools had these limits, that you could apply them and you could use them for something, but then if you tried to use them for something else, that they wouldn't be valuable. And then he says that there should be a science, there should be like a field of study that studies this called theory of repair. So theory of repair would take the different, you know, approaches to repair and classify them so no one would ever be confused about this again. And there could be a book, you know, and you could look up, okay, woodworking tools are for wood, you know, auto tools are for working on cars. And he says, you know, why hasn't this been done before? So he decides to start this new science, you know, this field of knowledge for that. Okay, so what this illustrates is that, like this carpenter who had the flat tire, you know, when we have to justify our beliefs, like for instance, if someone tells me that they don't believe that there's a God, and they say, justify for me, why do you believe in God? Then I know that I have to bring some sort of approach to knowledge in order to, you know, to justify it. I have to, you know, be able to say something. But if I don't bring the right approach to knowledge, then I might make this situation even worse than it was before, like with Maulana giving the example of the Christians and the Muslims having a debate. Like if I start bringing just quotes from Quran, and I point out the flaws of the Bible, for instance, then the Christian might, you know, just leave offended rather than seeing any sort of, you know, value in what I'm saying. But on the other hand, if I, you know, just bring an approach that's just logical without referring to to Islamic sources and things like that that the Christian is not going to accept anyway, then there's a better possibility, if I'm using that approach to knowledge, that, you know, that the dialogue will actually get somewhere. So this is to illustrate, so theory of knowledge is about taking the different approaches to knowledge and developing an understanding of when's the right situation to use each approach. And also looking at the common mistakes, you know, that people make. And so by the end of this course, you know, inshallah, the hope is that we'll have that awareness and that, you know, you can start directly applying it not only to yourself, like if you think about, why do I believe, you know, in God? Or why do I believe, you know, that there's one God? Or why do I believe this? You know, and it could get down to the smallest details of your belief, of examining those and seeing if you're applying, you know, correctly, the correct approaches to knowledge in the correct way. But then also when you're talking to other people, whether you're talking to people of a different religion, or even people of the same religion who, you know, approach it in a different way or have different, you know, specific beliefs, you know, then you can apply.
Yes, before, you know, I think I'll just add something and then you go back to the other story you gave related to the subject itself, right? The example I gave, that girl next to me I was talking about, you know, and, well, I said, you know, you don't believe in my book and I don't believe in your book, right? That was clear. So I said, fine, so there has to be some other way we can talk to each other, which we both agree on, right? And she said, well, I don't know of any such way, because this, what other way can we have? We are believers. We believe in our book. That's where our reference point is. I said, well, before being believers or Muslims or Christians, we are something else. Right? We are humans. And we all have a power of reason. Even to accept Christianity or believe in something, we have to use our minds. Our intellect has to accept something, right, before we believe in it. It should make sense to me that I have to be a Muslim. Whether my arguments are correct or incorrect, but I have to have some kind of argument, some kind of reason why I believe in Christianity or Islam or whatever. So she said, well, thought about it a little bit, she said, well, makes sense. It has to be something that we all have in common, correct? So, reason. And reason and logic, the ability to you know, think in broad terms, and then when figure out certain principles which we agree on, and then start applying those principles as human beings to say, okay, you know, with these principles in mind that we agree on, let's now start looking at, you know, all these other things that are out there. What is right, what is wrong. Figure out what reasons are right, what arguments are wrong, stuff like that, right?
So there's another story in here, on the next page. So the first story doesn't exactly tell you what theory of knowledge is, because it's more about tools, right? Like these physical things and how you apply the physical things. So we put another narrative in here that illustrates actually how theory of knowledge, you know, would, what the analogy would be, you know, with the tools. So this next story is the scientist who wanted to prove God's existence. So so this is very similar. You'll see many similarities to the other story. So there's this young physics student, and he really admires the achievements of science. So he looks at, you know, like how science has understood, you know, matter and atoms and molecules and how elements come together and all these things and the achievements of, you know, that lead to technology, you know, of all types, like computers and flight and all these things. So he has a lot of admiration for all of these technological and scientific achievements. But also at the same time, his parents, you know, raised him to be a religious person. So he has, you know, in his heart a strong belief in God. But what he notices as he's doing his studies, he notices that most of the scientists that he admires, they don't seem to put that much importance in religion, you know, or religious belief or God. And so he starts to have this conflict in himself, and he starts thinking, well, if there is a God, then God's existence, it must be possible to prove it. Right? Now, up until this point, his main training is in science, so he decides, I'm going to be the first person to scientifically prove that God exists. So he finishes his studies and everything, he becomes a scientist, and He's well respected and everything. And then at some point he decides, okay, he's going to take a few years off or something, and he's going to work on this project of scientifically proving the existence of God. And he comes up with some theories about, you know, how to prove this, and then he designs some experiments. He goes into the laboratory, you know, makes some observations, does a lot of experiments, but in the end he finds that he's getting nowhere. That either through the experiments he can't prove or disprove God. So he's thinking either God doesn't exist, or it's impossible to prove whether he exists or not, and so therefore it's impossible to know anything about God. But these two conclusions really depress him, because, like, up until that point, you know, in his heart, like, this has been an important thing, and, you know, religion gave meaning to his life and everything. So just like the carpenter, he, you know, goes into despair. He feels, you know, like everything he's been doing up until that point is meaningless. But he also has a friend. Now, the friend who comes by is a philosopher. And the philosopher asks him, you know, what's the problem? And the scientist says, you know, explains that, I've been doing these experiments, I really want to prove the existence of God, but it seems like it's not possible to prove. So how can you believe in something that you can't prove? How can you believe something that you have no knowledge of? The philosopher says, well, you know, you've been doing all these experiments, you've been using this scientific approach, but science uses the senses. Science is all about measuring things, you know, like looking at physical things and being able to measure them by observing them, you know, either with your senses or with, you know, instruments and machines. But the philosopher says, but if God, by definition, God has to be something that you can't see, that you can't, you know, detect with your senses, because God isn't this physical thing. So he says, you've just been using the wrong approach to knowledge to try to prove God. If you want to prove the existence of God, you can't use the scientific approach to it. You know, so then the scientist, he says, well, this is great, you know, why didn't I know about this before? There should be, you know, a field of knowledge, like a, you know, a science or something, a study that deals with this issue of, like, where is the scientific approach useful and where is it not useful? Whereas, you know, these other approaches, like a purely rational or logical approach, where is that useful? And the philosopher says, well, there is such a discipline, and that it's called the theory of knowledge. So, this course, you know, so with these two examples, hopefully you can see, like, what the purpose, you know, this course is that we don't want to frustrate ourselves by trying to prove things with the wrong approach, you know, because it's really, you know, a waste of time, and it can leave us feeling like, you know, the approach that we're using itself, you know, is not, you know, is not effective. You know, something.
Yes, so when I illustrated that reason is what is common between all of us, all human beings, with that girl, you know, I was talking to, we all share intelligence, we have the ability to reason and think. So, and she agreed on, I said, well, the one quality of logical reasoning is that if it's applied correctly, the conclusion is drawn very easily, and it's automatic, right? Now I'm illustrating this for you right now. For example, this relates to the field of logic itself. And we are not studying logic here. But perhaps, you know, if this course we inshallah all participate and we finish this, you'll appreciate how powerful this tool is. In just regular conversations with your friends, other co-workers, people that you talk to, you see how powerful and effective it is. And if you apply the rules of logic, then inshallah, if you complete this course and you study logic, and we want to offer the course in logic afterwards, if you follow the rules of logic, which is when you design an argument, the form of the argument and the content of argument are both yaqini. You know, yaqeen means they are based on conviction. Undeniable, like self-evident, you know, based on self-evident principles. Self-evident. The form is the best form of argument. The content of the argument, the material, the substance that you have used to bring together that argument is also yaqini. Then the conclusion, the natija, the conclusion of that argument is is compelling. It's convincing, yaqini. It's like something like, you know, like an experiment. carbon and oxygen, whatever, the experiments that you have in lab, they produce the same result. The results from experiment are always the same. Chemical reaction that produces the same result under the same conditions, always. If you follow the rules, you'll have the same conclusion. The example that went out on the email is a pretty good example of that. For example, you observe this universe around you, and you observe that there is order. Right? The sun rises from the east, sets in the west. Right? Seasons go, come and go in the same order. Same things happen. Right? There's order how, birds give birth to their offspring. The order in how human beings give birth to their, babies. I don't know. There's order in everything that you see around you. Nature, rain, clouds, everything that you see around you, order. Order in which the earth, circulates, revolves around the sun, other galaxies, I'm trying to discover the order. They see there's some kind of, there is order, but what are the formulas and rules that apply? They don't know, they don't even discover. So, you see an order around you, correct? Then you also see a purpose in this order. It's meant to do this. Human beings are created or they are built in this way so that they can produce, for example, an offspring. Right? Human beings are built like this so that they can walk on 2 feet, for example, right? They have eyes so that all of that is seen as a purpose. Humans can perceive things, think about them, apply them, all of these seems to be a very purposeful creation. So there's order in the universe, there's a purpose in the universe, in nature. You understand that? That's one statement. Statement number one. Statement number two would be, when there is order, where there is order and purpose, it needs an organizer who has knowledge. Right? Just like you go to a library, you see the order. Books have been catalogued, put in the right places. What do you see? Wow, these people are so organized. They know what they're doing, right? They have organized this. These people, that means there's an organizer. They know what they're doing. They have knowledge. So it's for a purpose. So you can easily find a book and people can have access to knowledge and information and read the books that they want to, correct? Find information. So, you observe order and purpose, then you say, well, for every order and purpose, there has to be an organizer who knows that purpose, and has designed everything to achieve that goal, correct? The result of that would be, this order in the universe requires an organizer that has knowledge, correct? This is the conclusion of this argument. The beauty of a logical argument is it cannot be challenged. Because for any human being, if you follow the rules, the form of the logical argument and the content and substance of the logical argument is based on yaqiniyat, correct? Based on burhan.
Have same belief.
Sorry?
They also have same belief. Same view. Same thing,
what did
you say?
Because
someone is
organized
and
most. Yeah, at least there's
we
order.
Difference. We have to tell them, like.
Do you mean, sister, do you mean Christians?
Yeah, or any other.
Right. But this could apply to like people who don't believe. This would be mainly an argument to people who don't believe in God.
Yeah.
For instance. So, like, if you're having a dialogue with atheists or, or someone who doesn't accept God, then that would be.
Yes. Different. Of course, people who question whether there's a God or not. There are people who don't believe in any of the, for example, Abrahamic faiths or any of the divine, traditions. So, you try to reason with them, reason with the non-believers, right? And this kind of an argument, this is just an example. There are many, many, many arguments to prove different things, right? And if you go through this course to find out how to classify an argument so that when a person is speaking to you, right? Before you try to answer the question, you must understand the question correctly. Classify the question. Okay, this question is coming from here, right? Based on this approach. And instead of trying to answer the question, you say, let me figure this out. You are trying to understand what point A is, right? And your approach is this approach. Sensory approach, for example, right? Wouldn't it be better to figure out, first of all, is this approach useful to figure out what point A is? Is this the right approach to address this subject or not? Wouldn't it be better, right? And maybe he says, I don't know. So you can start from there. In fact, go several steps back and start the discussion from really point zero, which is whether there is a reality we are trying to understand or not. Whether there is a reality or not. If there is a reality we are trying to discover, then we have to see, okay, what are the ways to discover the reality? If there is no reality, what's the point in talking about how to find out? For example, if a person you are talking to says there's no truth out there, it's all a mess. It's totally confusing. Nobody knows what this is about, why we are here, what is this whole place. And in fact, whether it's there or not, it's probably just all an illusion. There are people who say this. This is all an illusion. You don't even know what is truth. There are some people. Well, if why not prepare ourselves to have a dialogue from the very first elementary stage? Take the discussion back to the original first principles. If those are established, then you find out, okay, and that's what we have listed in 10 basic pillars of this course. And these are the 10 basic pillars we will be, inshallah, working on.
Can I ask what this package, this is just the first section of the package. We're developing this text as we go along. But if you look on the second page, there's the table of contents. So each session that we meet, inshallah, we'll have the next part of this text ready. But if you look at the way the chapters are arranged, basically the structure of the course would be starting with the most basic question. Like if you look at chapter one, it's, is there a reality outside of our minds? So we'll start from the most basic thing and then move step by step to the most basic thing is the thing where there's the most certainty, right? So if you can establish first that the thing that's closest to the obvious truths, right? And then you move further and further away from the obvious things, but you build logically, from those. So the effectiveness of this, of building from the, like, just this first question, is there a reality outside of our minds, is that when you're talking with someone, one of the first things that you have to ask yourself, whether they call themselves a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or an atheist, whatever they call themselves, you might find in talking to them that actually they have some beliefs that don't even go with that classification. Like, for instance, you might talk to a Muslim, but in the process of the dialogue find that they don't even believe that truth is absolute, for instance, which chapter 4 we'll talk about is truth relative. Right? They might have some kind of belief that shows that in practice, they don't even accept that. So the power of this is that if we go through this step by step, then if you're talking to someone or looking at your own beliefs, then you can figure out, what is the fundamental step that this dialogue needs to be at. Right?
Yes, inshallah. So we plan to, inshallah, continue these in this